How can we envision the sweeping changes to entire landscapes?
Ownership of commons, the air, soils, water, biological diversity.
Cultural diversity is as critical as biological diversity.
In this epic struggle to preserve a habitable
planet, that is the only thing which is sustained.
Every place that you love is now under siege.
Deregulated commerce is becoming a threat to the life on this planet.
These are system problems.
Our humanity is at
stake. We shouldn't ask whether we can survive.
These are existential questions as much as they are systemic questions.
Action informed by knowledge of place.
You're listening to the Schumacher Lectures, a channel hosted by the Schumacher Center for a New Economics. The Schumacher Lectures feature speakers who challenge entrenched ways of thinking while exploring how to build a new economy that serves both people and the planet.
Any public program to preserve land or produce food is hopeless if it does not tend to right the balance between numbers of people and acres of land, and to encourage long-term stable connections between families and small farms.
Let's have a look at it.
Today, you will hear from Indigenous author, activist, and lawyer Julian Agen, who delivered the following lecture titled Felled by Beauty, Guam and the End of American Empire at the 41st Annual E.F. Schumacher Lectures on October 24th, 2021. But first, a brief introduction from author, social activist, and filmmaker Naomi Klein.
Welcome, everyone. What an honor it is to be introducing our exciting speaker, Julian Agen. It's also a heavy responsibility, so I wanted to have with me this beautiful shell that Julian sent to me from Guam. Guam is a place I've never been to, but to which I nonetheless feel a strange, intimate connection. And that's because Julian built a bridge made of words between his part of the Pacific and mine, here on unceded Coast Salish territory in so-called British Columbia, the lands of the Shishat people where I am grateful to live and where I'm speaking to you from. I keep this conch close to me where I write because it's a potent symbol for calling people together in common cause. The conch also raises the alarm. It spreads the word. These are things that our speaker does every day, using a dazzling array of gifts and tools. Tools that combine gentleness and toughness in equal measure. That's because Julian knows that the change that we need in the world requires both of those forces. So he fights for legal change through international courts, and he also fights for social and emotional change with his spellbinding prose about cliffside flowers and the changing tides in Guam. As an author, activist, and human rights lawyer, Julian is simply one of those rare beings who refuses to choose between head and heart. That makes him a very good friend to have, but colonial powers and ecocidal corporates beware, because you do not want him as an enemy. Just this past year, Julian's law firm, Blue Ocean Law, helped secure a historic win for his people, Guam's Chamorro. For the first time in 55 years, the special rapporteurs of the United Nations Human Rights Council issued a joint letter putting the U.S. on notice that it needs to halt its devastation of sacred lands and abuse of the Chamorro people. And just 1 month after that historic legal win, Julian's latest book, The Properties of Perpetual Light, was published, and to great acclaim. Now, Julian sent me an advanced copy of this book last summer with a shy request for a blurb, no pressure. In truth, I really didn't have time. I was in the middle of a pandemic, I was overworked and overwhelmed with life, and I was ready to let him down. But then I started reading, and I couldn't stop. So I'll share with you what I wrote for him. Here's what I wrote. I did not know I needed this book until it had me in its embrace like the oldest and dearest of friends from the very first page. Overflowing with warmth and wisdom and defying all categorizations, The properties of perpetual light is philosophy, poetry, memoir, history, and self-help for humanity. With bottomless love for his people and place, Aguan guides us through a portal to the Pacific, sharing deep insights earned from life on the existential knife's edge. Now, I had plenty of company, it turns out, in being bowled over by this book. Alice Walker remarked that, quote, its fierce love of the land, the ocean, the elders, and the ancestors warms the heart and moves the spirit. Juno Diaz called it, quote, a breathtaking book, and I mean it. This book took my breath away. The property of perpetual light is so alive with passion, wisdom, and heart, you can almost feel its pulse, a call not only for justice, but for a brand new covenant with our world. So, I trust you are starting to see how lucky we are to be in Julian's company today and why I am so honored to offer a few more words of introduction. Now, in addition to his writing, Julian is an Indigenous Shamaru activist, and his legal work is breaking ground at the intersection of international Indigenous rights and climate justice. At age 28, he founded his own law firm to advance the self-determination struggles of Native and non-self-governing people in the Pacific region. His projects have included working with the Marshall Islands to seek redress for the harms of nuclear testing, fighting to protect the land rights of the Indigenous peoples of the Northern Mariana Islands, and providing lawmakers from small island states with legal and regulatory tools to better protect their natural resources. Julian is a founding board member of Prutahi Letexan, a new Indigenous-led organization that's been fighting to protect their ancestral lands and culture against the onslaught of the unprecedented U.S. military buildup in Guam. Currently, Julian is working with the Pacific Network on Globalization to ensure protection of Indigenous rights in the face of the emergent deep-sea mining industry. Julian serves on as legal counsel to Guam's legislature and was appointed special assistant to Attorney General to defend the decolonization process, specifically the right of the native inhabitants of Guam to freely choose their political status. Julian was named a human rights hero, which he is, by the Petra Foundation for his work advancing the rights of his own and other Pacific peoples. One of the loveliest things about Julian's writing, especially in this new book, is the deep warmth with which he appreciates and supports the people in his life. You'll read the most beautiful tributes to teachers and mentors and elders. That's part of what has made it such a pleasure to just spend a little bit of time appreciating my colleague, co-conspirator, and friend, Julian Aguan. Over to you, Julian, and thank you all.
The last thing I said to my father when he was still alive was how much I hated him for having cancer. And I hated him hardest the night before he died. It was Halloween. I was a teenage mutant ninja turtle, Donatello. And all I wanted in the world was to get as far away from that hospital as I could. The hospital that smelled like spite and served as a second home to my siblings and me in the months leading up to his death. I threw an epic fit after being told my chances of going trick-or-treating weren't good. I fretted as the hours rolled by, convinced there'd be no candy left by the time I got there. I let every adult in my dad's hospital room, including my dad, know how much I hated being there, hated cancer, hated him. I nagged my poor mother so hard she finally relented and told my oldest brother and his wife, who had just flown in from the States, to take my sister and me to the mall. I knew the candy there wouldn't be half as good as the candy from the houses in Nimitz Hill. But I was dying to get out of there, dying to breathe some other air, dying to have just a little bit of fun. But of course, it was my dad who was dying. Unbeknownst to me, he had been rapidly declining all that day and was, according to the doctors, decidedly on his way out of the world. Of course, I understood none of this then. At 9, one cannot read the signs. cannot see the harried pacing of nurses for what it is, cannot see the emptiness in a soon-to-be widow's eyes. After we buried him, we moved permanently into the house on the hill. The blue and white house on the highest hill in Mount Santa Rosa. The house where everything rusted from the saltwater winds that blew in with a vengeance from the Philippine Sea. The house that was never a home. I hated that house. So did my sister. I suspect my brother did too, though he never said so. It's hard to tell because we barely spoke at the time, at least not about anything that mattered. In fact, I mostly avoided him. In fact, we mostly avoided each other. Each of us mourned in our own way. My mom by crying, my sister by self-isolating, my brother by leaving, and me by eating. Believe it or not, though, that wasn't even the problem. The problem, as I see it now, was that each of us mourned alone, as opposed to together. I see it so clearly. Each of us an island, all of us at sea. We didn't stand a chance. Luckily, we each found something to get us through those deeply lonely years. My mom found she could disappear into her work. My brother found a girlfriend. My sister found Janet Jackson and a bunch of our dad's old shirts, which she wore religiously because she smelled him in them. And I found a whole wide world on that red dirt mountain. The first thing I found was a family of tree snails, which I'd spent hours watching, wondering why they moved so slowly, wondering if they could, if they had to, move swiftly enough to save their own lives. I found so many things after that. I found I could slide down the smaller slopes at the back of my house if I had just the right piece of cardboard. I found out the hard way that before one runs through an open field of sword grass, one should wear a long-sleeved shirt. I found no need for a bike. I found butterflies in abundance. I found more grasshoppers than I could count. I studied them closely, that is, when they let me get close. I was awed by how far their little legs could take them. I couldn't, for the life of me, fathom how such small legs could support such big hops. I wondered endlessly about wings. I was envious of everything that could fly. I prayed without knowing how to, for wings of my own. I wasn't the only one. Further down the dirt road, my friend hanged himself in his house. The house closest to the bus stop where we took the bus to school every day. The house where words were shouted, not spoken. The house that was never a home. I learned so many things after that. I learned that same friend was an artist, that he loved to draw, that he drew a picture of a friend just before he died, that he tucked it away in a box beneath his bed, that he was capable of gentleness. I did not exactly know that because my friend was also sometimes my bully. But that's the other thing I learned, that when we are in pain, we inflict pain. That when we feel we can no longer breathe, we grab other people's air. I also learned this. Jigo, the village we lived in, comes from the Chamorro word zugu. Zugu means yoke, as in to bear a heaviness or to carry a burden. We all bore that heaviness, my sister most of all. I know this because once when I was 10 and she was 11, I found her outside in the middle of the night wearing nothing but my dad's old shirt, which she had washed one too many times and which she said no longer smelled like him. Though it had been only 1 year since he died, I was beginning to be able to read the signs. I could see the emptiness in her eyes. I changed my prayer right then and there. I prayed for her wings, not mine. I wanted to begin my remarks with this passage, which is taken from a book I had published earlier this year entitled The Properties of Perpetual Light. While it is arguably the most personal essay in the collection, I realize now that there are still so many things I did not say, at least not explicitly. Things that warrant elaboration, things that bear directly on the subject at hand, which is to say, the work of confronting empire. For instance, I did not talk about how my father made a living, how for years he worked as a plumber and a pipe fitter, including at one point for the Navy. He fitted pipes at the Naval Ship Repair Facility down at Apra Harbor, the island's only deep water harbor, the same harbor where, in the summer of 1946, the Navy sent several radioactive warships to be decontaminated. These vessels were part of a larger fleet detonated in the Marshall Islands as part of Operation Crossroads. During that operation, two nuclear weapons dubbed Able and Baker were detonated in the Bikini Atoll Lagoon, purportedly for the purpose of studying the effects of radiation on naval warships. No less than 18 of these irradiated vessels were brought to Guam and flushed out. To this day, Apra Harbor remains highly toxic. In fact, it's one of 30 Superfund sites on the island. For anyone who doesn't know what a Superfund site is, it's a place that the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency considers especially hazardous, requiring a long-term cleanup response. Nor did I mention that it wasn't just my dad who worked there and later contracted cancer. To be sure, an alarming number of people who worked at that same ship repair facility have come down with cancer or other diseases. Several of my closest friends, in fact, including Lisa Natividad, who you will hear from tonight, have had at least one parent who has worked there. Cancer got them too. So though it may sound startling, it is not sensational to say that in Guam, we seem to be in the business of always coming back from burying the dead. This felt spectacularly true last year while I was writing Perpetual Light. Written at the height of the pandemic, the book became a way for me to process my grief, and not just grief occasioned by the loss of family members and friends to COVID-19, but grief brought on by a battery of daily reminders of our current political status as colonized subjects of the American empire. In March 2020, when it became clear that the coronavirus outbreak could not be contained on board the USS Theodore Roosevelt, the Navy transferred thousands of its sailors to as many as 7 local hotels, though promising to house only sailors who had tested negative for the virus. Multiple sailors who were staying at these hotels later tested positive. All told, 1,150 sailors from the Roosevelt would eventually test positive. In June, 15 airmen from an Anderson Air Force Base unit were caught violating lockdown orders during their stay at the Guam Reef Hotel. The unit soon had 35 confirmed positive cases, making up 42% of total active cases on island at the time. Some 30 local businesses and their employees were exposed to the virus as a result of these ordinance violations. Making matters worse, military officials refused to respond to requests for information on the airmen's activities or account for their whereabouts for contact tracing purposes. According to Guam's Attorney General, these officials refused to provide information needed by our local public health department to determine what, if any, protocols were followed. In short, the island was a fishbowl not only for death, but for different kinds of dying. But here's the rub. The grief I felt last year, and several months into this one, felt different. It felt wide, capacious, Rather than having an isolating effect, as grief so often does, it drew me closer to other people. Instead of a wall, it was a bridge. My heart was not just breaking, it was breaking open. The best way I can explain it is with something Alice Walker said once, that the way forward is with a broken heart. With that, I want to tell you about what's happening now in my homeland, the land of the Chamorro people, my people, whose hearts are most certainly breaking. Our story begins in 2006 when the United States inked a deal with the government of Japan to relocate thousands of U.S. Marines from Okinawa to Guam. The deal grew out of growing unrest among the people of Okinawa, who've been forced to shoulder the enormous and enormously violent U.S. military presence there. But the Marines' relocation is also part of bigger plans the country has for this region, plans which center around the geopolitical objective of containing China's rise as a global power. To be fair, the plans have been in the works for a while. According to Joseph Gerson, former director of the AFSC Economic Security Program, U.S. strategists since the Clinton administration have determined it of the, quote, utmost importance to ensure China's integration into U.S.-dominated global systems through engagement and, as necessary, containment, end quote. Former Assistant Secretary of State Kurt Campbell once said, quote, the United States is a Pacific nation, and in every regard, geopolitically, militarily, diplomatically, and economically, the Asia and Pacific are indispensable to seizing the opportunities of the 21st century. And let us not forget the ominous declaration made in Honolulu in 2011 by then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton that this was and is America's, quote, Pacific century. One could argue that though the drawings were done earlier, they were certainly stamped in the Obama years under the rubric of the Pacific Pivot. One could also argue that our story began a much longer time ago. After all, the people of Guam have been colonized for nearly 500 years, first by Spain for three centuries, then by the United States since the close of the Spanish-American War in 1898. Then by Japan for a brief but bloody stint during the Second World War. Then again by America in the post-war period. Since then, however, we have been reared on a very steady diet of dispossession. The period of naval control which followed World War II firmly entrenched our subordination. The U.S. government viewed Guam as an ideal naval base for strategic purposes and governed its indigenous inhabitants paternalistically, attempting to assimilate the Chamorro people. Under naval rule, English was mandated and the Chamorro language was banned in schools and other public places. Everything was banned in those days, even dresses of a certain length, even church bells, even whistling. Although a military plan to put our people on reservations did not materialize, Chamorros continued to be denied citizenship and various political rights. Thus, our leaders spent the post-war period fighting for greater autonomy, resulting in Congress's eventual passage of the Organic Act of Guam in 1950. The Organic Act established Guam as an organized, unincorporated territory, giving us a framework for civil government and a qualified form of U.S. citizenship. However, the federal statute reserved the power of Congress to amend any law that we passed or legislate for us directly. It also provided the Interior Department with supervisory authority over the entire government of Guam, while still denying us the right to participate in national government. To this day, even though our fate is ever in the hands of the federal government, we cannot vote for president, we have no Senate representation, and we can only elect one non-voting delegate to the House. So at the same moment, the international mandate of decolonization was sweeping the rest of the world, the U.S. was expanding its foothold in Guam. Rather than returning land seized during the war, the military executed an aggressive policy of land grabbing, taking some of the best and most valuable land and water resources and denying us access to many of our ancestral sites. Many local landowners received little or no compensation for land that was taken. My uncle, Tony Artero Sablan, a longtime activist who has been held at gunpoint too many times to count, told me once that his mother, Tan Isabel, couldn't even afford to buy a few dozen eggs with the money the military paid her for her acre of land. Land located in what is now Anderson Air Force Base. In addition to land theft, the U.S. military presence has had devastating effects on the health of our people. As already mentioned, this includes contamination from the country's 16-year-long nuclear testing program in the Marshall Islands, where it detonated 67 atomic and thermonuclear weapons. In addition to the ships that were flushed out at the local harbor, Guam received significant radioactive debris from the fallout itself. According to the National Research Council, the people of Guam should be eligible for compensation under the Radiation Exposure Compensation Act due to the measurable fallout we received from the tests. But to date, nobody here has received such compensation, despite a congressional panel's findings that the military, quote, knowingly put us in harm's way. U.S. military control of Guam has resulted in a number of other ecological and health disasters as well. These include the dumping and burying of toxic chemicals around the island after World War II and the storage and use of Agent Orange during the Vietnam and Korean Wars. We know this because multiple veterans have given sworn testimony that they sprayed Agent Orange and other defoliants along the fuel pipeline that runs from Upper Harbor to Anderson Air Force Base and also along the runway's edges in order to keep them clear of vegetation. These veterans have suffered from multiple diseases. One, Leroy Foster, a master sergeant in the Air Force, developed Parkinson's and ischemic heart disease before dying in 2018. His daughter developed cancer as a teenager, and his grandchild was born with 12 fingers, 12 toes, and a heart murmur. Despite a growing body of evidence, the U.S. government still denies the use of Agent Orange in Guam. The Department of Defense, or DOD, has admitted to storing some 5,000 drums of Agent Purple in Guam in anticipation for use on the Korean Peninsula. Fast forward to the present day, when even COVID-19 hasn't been able to slow down DOD. In fact, the $10 billion buildup was accelerated during the pandemic. Construction has begun on Camp Blas, the brand new Marine Corps base that will house the 5,000 Marines being relocated from Okinawa. Camp Blas bears the distinction of being the first Marine Corps base to be built anywhere in the country since 1952. A total of 12 sets of skeletal remains were found at the construction site. Archaeologists confirmed that this particular burial plot was intergenerational, housing a handful of elderly men and women, several adolescents, and a few young children. Two burials contain two individuals each, with two older adults stacked head to foot, and an adult cradling an infant. Though the military described these disturbances as, quote, inadvertent discoveries, end quote, invoking the cold language of craniums and femurs, we know better. This was a family. This was a mother cradling her child. Ground has also been broken along the island's beautiful northern coastline for the military's live fire training range complex. The complex, consisting of 5 training ranges and support facilities, is being built dangerously close to the island's primary source of drinking water, the Northern Guam Lens Aquifer. The complex is also situated over a sacred site, including the remnants of several ancient villages where our ancestors' remains remain. Just this month, A $122 million contract was awarded to Black Construction to build a 59-acre multi-purpose machine gun range. The company has begun clearing 89 acres of primary limestone forests and 110 acres of secondary forest. It is bitterly ironic that so many of these machines bear the name Caterpillar, when the very thing they are destroying is that precious creature's preciously singular habitat. To be sure, these forests house the host plants for the endemic Mariana eight-spot butterfly. They also serve as essential habitat for several endangered endemic species, including a fruit bat, a flightless rail, and three species of tree snails. Not to mention a swiftlet, a starling, and a slender-toed gecko. If only empires were concerned with the stuff of lowercase earth, like forests and fresh water. If only they were curious about the whisper and scurry of small lives. If only they were moved by beauty. If only. But the militarization of Guam is nothing if not proof that they are not so moved. So we are moving instead. A group of activists led by young indigenous women has emerged in fierce opposition to these firing ranges. They call themselves Protehi La Texan, which refers to the Chamorro name for the site where the ranges are being built. Their members include many of the original landowners of that area whose land was forcibly taken by the federal government and whose ancestors remain buried there. They also include other cultural practitioners, including traditional healers who will be denied access to the various medicinal plants that grow in that area. The group draws support from folks across various sectors of the community, from farmers and fishermen to teachers, social workers, and more. Since its inception, the group has organized over 450 actions, including letter writing campaigns, meetings with lawmakers, school visits, rallies, comment drives, protests, press conferences, land tours, legislative roundtables, public hearings, election surveys, media interviews, podcasts, webinars, and other efforts to raise public awareness. They have also successfully advocated for local legislation calling for a halt to certain construction activities. One of their petitions has garnered nearly 25,000 signatures to date. Earlier this year, I had the honor of representing the group before the UN Human Rights Council, together with the Brussels-based United Nations and People's Organization. My law firm managed to secure a joint allegation letter signed by three of its special rapporteurs, namely the Special Rapporteur on the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, the Special Rapporteur on Human Rights and the Environment, and the Special Rapporteur on Toxics and Human Rights. In their letter, these human rights experts condemn the United States government for failing to protect the rights of the Chamorro people. I would like to read you a small portion of what they wrote. Quote, "The military buildup directly impairs the ability of the indigenous Chamorro to self-govern and threatens to cause additional and irreparable harm to the land and sea environments on and around Guam. In addition to current threats, residual nuclear contamination from historical U.S. weapons testing has not been effectively remedied and continues to threaten the rights of the Chamorro. The Chamorro people have not provided their free, prior, and informed consent in connection with the ongoing expansion of U.S. military bases and its accompanying increase in personnel on Guam. The military escalation risks increased contamination to the drinking water, loss of wildlife and biodiversity, irreversible damage of their traditional lands, territories, and resources, loss of traditional livelihoods, cultural sites, and heritage, and threatens the physical and cultural survival of the Chamorro." End quote. Suffice it to say, we were pleased with the outcome. Apart from validating the deeply held belief in every oppressed people's heart that might does not make right, it was the first time in 55 years of advocacy that we ever got anything truly substantive out of the UN. George Monbiot, in last year's Schumacher lecture, said something quite powerful. He said that the great failure of the left is that we've neglected the role of narrative in the project of bringing about political change, and we've paid dearly for it. One of the reasons we're so stuck at the moment, he says, is because we haven't developed a new narrative to get us unstuck. And now, with the neoliberalist era having come to a close, it is time to come forward with new offerings, new stories, new versions of what it means to be human on the planet. In other words, it is time to articulate an alternative to predatory global capitalism and replace its ethos of extraction with one of our own. For my people, that would be an ethos of reciprocity. And nowhere is that ethos more alive than in the very same forests where the firing ranges are being built. For it is there that our zoomti, or healers, are keeping our culture alive. In particular, our traditional healing practices. It is there on the forest floor and in the crevices of the limestone rock that many of the plants needed to make our medicine grow. It is there that our medicine women gather the plants that their mothers and their mothers' mothers gathered before them. These plants, combined with others harvested from elsewhere on the island, treat everything from anxiety to arthritis. As someone who suffers from bronchitis, I can attest to the fact that the medicine Auntie Frances Menno makes to treat respiratory problems has proven more effective in my case than any medicine of the modern world. Yet Auntie Frances, like so many other zoomti I know, takes no credit for the cure. As she tells it, to be so would be hubris, as so many others are involved in the healing process. The plants themselves, with whom she converses in a secret language. Her mother, who taught her how to identify which plants have which properties, and also how and when to pick them. And the ancestors, who give her permission to enter the jungle and who, on occasion, favor her, allowing her to find everything she needs and more. More than this, she tells me that I too am part of that process, that people like me who seek out her services give her life meaning, that she wouldn't know what to do with herself if she wasn't making medicine, that the life of a healer was always hers to have because she was born breech under a new moon and thus had the hands for healing. But such things are inevitably lost in translation, and no military on earth is sensitive enough to perceive something as soft as a whisper of another worldview. But perhaps that's where we should start, by listening to indigenous peoples. Because we have much older imaginations, imaginations that predate the neoliberalist one that has all but destroyed the earth, we have part of the answer to the question of how to get out of this mess. We also represent that subset of humankind most directly connected to the physical world, and as a consequence, we are the most vulnerable to the vandalism visited upon it. Perhaps that's what real listening looks like, radical listening. It's listening to the voices of those who are more vulnerable than us, whose lives are more precarious than our own. I think that matters. I also think that, without knowing it, I've been doing it all my life. As I mentioned at the start of my talk, after my father died, I watched my family fall to pieces. Frightened and in many ways alone, I found solace in the natural world, befriending butterflies and inspecting grasshoppers as closely as I could. I found tree snails, which I'd spend hours watching, wondering if they could ever move swiftly enough to save their own lives. I realize only now that that was the most formative moment of my life. I realize only now that I learn empathy from insects, from mollusks. And now I am not alone. Together with my people, we have our ear to the ground, and we are listening to the Mariana 8-spot butterfly, whose limestone forest home is being raised for the aforementioned machine gun range. We are doing what we can to save her. We are filing petitions and protesting. We are working to save the two rare plants whose leaves she lays her eggs on. We are suing Fish and Wildlife on her behalf. We are not naive. We know we might not save her. But we also know we owe it to her to fight at least as hard as she does. Though far less famous than her sister, the monarch butterfly, she is just as strong, if not stronger. Whereas her sister goes through 5 larval instars, she goes through 6. It stops my blood to think about that. She has to die 6 times in order to live. I want to end with a passage from one of the best books I've ever read, Ocean Vuong's On Earth, We're Briefly Gorgeous. Throughout the story, the main character, Little Dog, insists that writing is a kind of freedom, that he writes not to make art, but to break free. For him, the creative impulse is this, quote, "I want to insist that our being alive is beautiful enough to be worthy of replication. And so what? So what if all I ever made of my life was more of it?" End quote. He carries the thought through to the end of the book where he writes, quote, "All this time, I told myself we were born from war. But I was wrong, Ma. We were born from beauty. Let no one mistake us for the fruit of violence, but rather that violence, having passed through the fruit, failed to spoil it." End quote. I want to thank Ocean, not only for his impossibly beautiful sentences, but also for reminding me of the centrality of beauty in the struggle for collective liberation. For reminding me who can be moved and who cannot. No empire can be felled by beauty, but thankfully, a human being can. Thank you.
To hear more talks like this one and discover more than 30 years of Schumacher lectures, visit centerfornew.org. The Schumacher Center for New Economics Research Library houses the collections of E.F. Schumacher, Robert Swan, and other influential thinkers in the new economy movement. You can strengthen our mission by purchasing a copy of your favorite Schumacher lectures at centerfornew.org/order-pamphlets. Our work is supported by listeners like you. You can donate to our cause at centerfornew.org/donate. This library and the Schumacher Lectures capture powerful voices for economic reform, voices with the strength to move and inspire. They frame and inform action, but are not themselves the action. At a time when our Earth is in crisis and our communities face complex challenges, we are all charged with creating solutions. The Schumacher Center's applied work seeks to implement the principles described by these speakers within the context of the Berkshire Hills of Massachusetts. This work includes crafting innovative leases that share equity and improvements while holding land in community trust, building Berkshares, a local currency designed to democratize monetary issue and keep money circulating in the region, and engaging citizens in supporting the development of regionally appropriate businesses, creating local jobs while retaining local ownership and control. You can support our work in a new economy by making a donation at centerforneweconomics.org/donate or call us at 413-528-1737 to make an appointment to visit our research library and office at 140 Jug End Road, Great Barrington, Massachusetts.